Anyway, it's not going to hurt anything. Let's speak into it. Senate Judiciary Committee meeting, January 12th, 1 p.m., room 407A.
I'll go down there and talk. Senate Judiciary Committee, room 407A, 1 p.m., January the 12th. Senate Judiciary Committee, January 12th, 1 p.m., room 407A.
Come to order and we start the hearing on Senate Bill 21. Senator Robbins, if you want to testify first.
Okay.
Want to adopt these rules, Madam Chairman?
I'd suggest, Madam Chairman, that rule number one be changed to a numerical figure. A majority of the members of the committee shall constitute a quorum. Majority of those present, question, you know, we say it, but
all right.
A quorum shall consist of four
members.
I move that it will be adopted. Suggest.
Is there any discussion?
On number eight, I was just wondering, it says the chairman may give an authority
by the committee.
That would be by the committee, giving by a majority vote.
We amend it. The amendment was that the chairman may be given authority by a majority of the committee members. All those in favor of adopting, please say aye.
Aye.
Senate Bill 21, this is a proposal for a recognition of common law marriages in Oregon, but only for a very limited purpose. As you know, I'm sure, Oregon has never recognized common law marriages. The proposal was brought before the Intercommittee on Social Services when we were working in the area of our domestic relations laws by Francis Harrington, who is a lawyer who is recognized, I think, in the entire legal profession in Oregon as an authority in domestic relations. Mr. Harrington, I understand, drafted and was the author of the no-fault divorce law that was adopted last session. And he's responsible for the terrible language that's in there on the famous or infamous language of the irreconcilable differences causing the irremediable breakdown of the marriage. And so he has served on the a number of the legal committees, the bar committees, dealing with domestic relations. Mr. Harrington said to our committee that he had had a number of cases in which after the death of one of the parties, it would be discovered by the other party that he or she could not inherit because they were not married. And though they perhaps should have known that this was not possible to inherit, though not married, of course they knew they were not married, but assumed that there would be no problems of inheritance at a later time, that in view of a number of these kinds of situations, that at least Oregon should recognize common law marriages for the purpose of inheritance. He gave the committee a number of factual situations and cases that had come before him in which parties would be married for 20 or 25 years, have children, but never ever for some reason or other went through the ceremonial part and getting the license, the legal requirement to recognize the legal marriage. But for all intents and purposes, in their minds and in their children's minds and so on, they were in fact married. But at the time then of inheritance, the spouse would be denied inheritance under our inheritance laws. Also, they would be denied such benefits as Social Security, veterans benefits, retirement benefits, and so on. So he proposed, and this is not a part of our domestic relations law, but is a part of our probate law. Mr. Harrington would suggest that we enact legislation which would provide only for the recognition of common law marriages after the death of one of the parties. And the recognition then would be made by the probate court. And in order to recognize the common law marriages, there are the requirements here that would have to be met. One requirement would be that the parties had lived together for 5 years prior to the death and had held themselves out as being husband and wife, and that they were both would have both been capable of contracting marriage during that five-year period. The other provision, or the other the alternative requirement that would be met would be that the parties had been married for 1 year, that they had been living together and held themselves out as husband and wife, and that a child had been born alive to the parties. And the 1 year there, because of the child being born, which would then allow the child, a child of course can inherit under our present probate laws, whether the mother and father were married. But in this case, the decrease of the 1 year would then allow the surviving spouse to inherit and to care for the child that had been born. So that's the objective of that proposal. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Yes, Madam Chair. Now, this sub C in 2. I think that should be. Should be clarified. I was trying to read it here. And a child is born alive to the parties, whether before, on, or after the date of death. Now, should this child be born within that last year before the death? In other words, should this child that's born have been born during the 1 year immediately preceding the death of the person which activates this section?
Okay. I think probably that is subject to interpretation. It was my feeling at the time that the child could have been born prior to the time the two parties began to actually live together and hold themselves out as husband and wife, but in fact the child was their child.
Well, then that might be a good policy, but don't we need more there?
I'd agree with you, Senator.
We've had a child born 20 years before the one of them. Well, what does that have to do with it?
But the child, in fact, was the child of both parties.
Well, now that's maybe what we need to put in. How are we going to establish? It seems to me that if we're going to go to a period before 1 year, there needs to be some way to ascertain that this child was the issue. It's not hard to figure out with a woman, but let's say, as far as the man is concerned, you need to have some establishment that this
right.
is that man's child.
Right.
Whenever
right.
it's recorded.
Right. I agree with that, and I don't, but you certainly can see a situation in which there might be a child born. And then after the child is a year or two old, they decide, look, you know, we have the child, and so now we want to live together, but we're not going to go through the ceremony. And so that child, you know, there still ought to be the provision for the protection of that child.
Can you think of a way that we could do that?
I hadn't put my mind to it, Senator Cook, so I have not.
I'd like the committee to meet Mr. John Reeder, who was the legal counsel. Mr. Winter, if you could try your hand at some amendments on the problem.
Madam Chairman. Betty, what do we do about the people that enter into common law marriages with the intent of no inheritance?
You mean they're single-minded?
All right, you're saying that they are living together, but one of the parties specifically does not want the other party to inherit.
Probably that's the reason for
the
common law
situation. That'd be the way to solve it.
Yeah,
they can
solve it by will.
I see.
And if they have not solved it by will, then of course the surviving spouse.
Except that's elections now. There might be an election problem there, but then. I guess that's a burden they're going to have. If you're going to live with someone for a year, well, they may be subject to their debt, to their wife getting a share of their estate, whether they want it or not. That's just the price they have to pay.
But if there is, in the absence of a will, the surviving spouse then would be able to inherit, whether the dead spouse wanted the inheritance to take place or not, if the surviving spouse could go and show it. So in order to prevent inheritance, it would seem to me that there would have to be a will.
Same thing that, you know, regular marriage.
Well, one more question,
yes.
Madam Chairman. Then how do you prevent, you know, the maid from claiming cohabitants with
the maid?
The rich.
The maid?
Yeah, the maid.
From claiming?
Yeah.
She will be put upon the proof there to
who
show.
Who decides that?
The probate judge. When the estate is being probated, and it would have to go before the court, and there would be evidence placed before the court on her claim, and then there could be those witnesses who would dispute her claim and who would put forth the evidence, and then it is the judge's decision on whether or not she meets the requirements for a common law wife. So in many of these cases, there would be the controversy. There would be the court. There would be the
test. I see that.
It's not. It's not very likely that the maid would be generally reputed to be the wife.
If she were,
they'd probably have a controversy before he died.
I'd
maybe
be on
result.
The maid side myself.
Now remember this. Now remember this, though, Senator Smith. There is the provision here. If you're assuming that there is a spouse also surviving and the maid is surviving, then there cannot be a common law marriage recognition because the provision is that they were both capable of entering into marriage, which means they could not have been married to somebody else because if you're married to somebody else, you're not capable of entering into a second marriage.
That's a bramble bush. I was just thinking.
Madam Chairman.
Senator
Roberts, you think it might be good to consider supervision here unless there is a will to the contrary. And then if there is, then that would that would be controlling and they couldn't claim any benefits at all under the unfortunate statute. And it would take care of the situation.
The will would control, wouldn't it? Or
well,
would it
no, there's still things in spite of a will under the statute.
He could take an elective share, I guess, if he could establish the husband, then there would be the elective share.
And if the two people living together, then they love their plan to share in each other's estate and make a will and have the absolute control.
I wouldn't have any objections to
I don't know if it's desirable or not, but I can see that at least they would already have provisions for wills, and you don't have people trying to enter into prenuptial agreements and then tend to get married.
Right, right. I would suggest.
Mr. Winter, would you make a try at that one?
I would suggest, Madam Chairman, that you issue an invitation to Mr. Harrington to come before the committee because he
has
does.
Been invited.
Okay.
Further questions, Mr. Senator?
Betty, all these four bills, whatever it is, that came out of your committee, they came out unanimously, were they?
No, Senator Brown and Representative Peck both voted against this bill. Hope we can convince her to change her vote. and I think I have, I think, I'll try to tell you on the other where there was a no vote as we go along here, Senator Ivers.
Any other questions on 21? Representative Peck, Senator Roberts asked to run through these bills and give her explanation, and then we will go back and see if we can reach one.
I need to get to another committee. I'm going to go past and then we'll turn it over to you. Senate Bill 22 was recommended to us by juvenile court judges, and you will find the new language that's being added to the domestic relations statutes on page 4 of section 2. Judge Jean Lewis testified before the committee and then submitted in writing her recommendations. She didn't submit her recommendations, she submitted a list that she uses as a guideline in determining custody of minor children in divorce proceedings. And Judge Lennon from Multnomah County also submitted his recommendations and list of guidelines. And from those, we then had legislative counsel draft kind of a compilation here that embodied most all of their own guidelines that they use. The purpose of this seemed to be, and it was made at the request of the domestic relations judges, that they would like to have in the statute specific things that they can refer to in evaluating a custody problem. We have already in the statute a list of guidelines for determining alimony, and it seemed to the judges that that children certainly are even more important than determining alimony payments, and that there ought to be some consistency between all of the courts of the state. So you will see there the numbers of things A through H are the items, and they're not necessarily listed in the order of preference, and I would assume there's no preference intended, and I assume that judges will sometimes place more emphasis on one than on the others. But you will also notice that in the language that the best interest and welfare of the child is to be considered, and so on. And again, Madam Chairman, I would suggest if there are any problems on this that you would contact the juvenile court judges. And on this bill, there was no opposition by committee members. It was unanimous vote.
Any questions?
The only thing, Madam Chairman, I would think that before we acted on this bill, let some time pass so that the juvenile court judges are aware of the fact that this is before us. I mean, I suspect that if anyone had an interest in it, this hearing is so soon at the beginning of the session that a lot of people wouldn't realize that it was about to be considered.
Any other questions?
Senate Bill 23 came out of our study on Children's Services Division. And my recommendation there to you, if you want further information, is to have someone from the Children's Services Division discuss this with you. The problem, it seems, the objective here, what we're trying to get at, is to make foster parents liable for any kind of negligence in the same degree that they are liable to their natural children. Currently, a foster parent must has a duty for a higher standard of care to foster children than foster parents have to their natural children. The foster parents tell us that either they buy insurance to cover them, which is exceedingly expensive, or they simply just hold their breath and hope that nothing happens to the child while the child is in their care. That may then cause a natural parent to bring some kind of legal action against them. If the child is injured in some kind of normal play activities or just the day-to-day living, then the foster parent could be liable for the injuries if it could be shown that they did not exercise the highest standard of care, not just ordinary care. So this bill would provide that foster parents would be held to no higher standard of care than natural parents. And it simply is in reverse language there in subsection 2, when it says that there shall be no action unless it is alleged and proved by the complaining party that the acts or omissions were the result of gross negligence or willful or wanton misconduct. And of course, that kind of action can be maintained against a natural parent by a natural child. And so it would in fact place it in the same relationship.
Madam Chairman, what specific individuals appeared before the committee in support of this proposal?
I don't have the minutes with me, Senator Cook, and I can get that for you and send it to you. Do you remember, Senator Brown?
No, there were people from Children's Services.
And there were a number of foster care parents.
Yes.
Well, has there been an instance that they could report?
Yes, there is one in their concern. We get the details.
Yeah, I'm leery of this kind of legislation. Foster parents, I'm not so sure that foster parents should have all the advantages that a natural parent has, particularly where there's reimbursement of any sort. I sure have some doubts about this one. You're going to have more hearings on that.
Senator Brown?
Do you mean that has there been a single case ever filed in the state of Oregon by a foster family or foster parent?
I can't answer that. I don't know that we have The problem that arises here, Senator Cook, is more in the area of medical services to these children, and whether or not the foster parent has acted under just ordinary care or has had to exercise exceptional care in caring for these children in a medical way. And the problem sometimes arises when the foster parent can neither reach the caseworker, who can give authority for medical care, or the natural parent. And when neither of those parties can be reached, then the foster parent must make a decision. If the foster parent, you know, makes a decision on medical care as he would to his own child, but there's something more serious wrong with the child, then this is what I think they're really fearful of, is that they'd be liable for suit.
Well, assuming that all that is a valid point, maybe if that's the only thing they're concerned about, then maybe the legislation ought to be drafted to cover that point. This is a very broad statute.
Well, I again urge you to hear some of the testimony that we heard before our committee before making your decision, because I think these people can relate specific incidents and their own fears and the cost of insurance and that's causing the cost of foster care anyway, that what we pay doesn't cover the cost, and some of the problems that from first-hand knowledge.
Other questions? Senate Bill 26.
by the way, there was no opposition on that last bill either. Senate Bill 26 is another domestic relations bill, and it would simply provide an alternate method of getting service on a spouse in a divorce proceeding, and is intended to prevent some of the cost of publication when the absent spouse cannot be located for the service. And though publication to most of us, I guess, would not appear to be terribly expensive, somewhere in the area of probably $30 to $40 for out-of-state publication, for notice of the pending divorce, it is a great deal of money to most persons who, and mostly women, who cannot find the absent husband, and therefore, in order to get a divorce, have to add that to the already tremendous cost of getting a divorce. So the language here would allow the mailing of the summons and petition to the resident at his last known resident, and also to be posted in a public place where the divorce proceeding is to take place. And it simply is just to provide an alternate way of giving notice with little or no cost.
Isn't there a piece from this bill?
I can't answer that.
Any questions?
I don't think it's been waived. The statute cannot be waived on this service. So I don't know what the basis in case
the case that approved for this kind of notice.
No.
Was there any testimony? Who testified on this? On the
This was also brought up by Mr. Harrington, and it was discussed then by the juvenile court judges when Jean Lewis appeared before the committee. We discussed this with her, and she saw no problems.
Actually, on this, application of the statute now. Court to waive the fees for the person by enforcement. They're very expensive relatively compared to other statutes. It costs $50.
$58.
And then you've got the service charge and so forth. As long as there's only the public involved, they can waive it. And when it comes to publishing a newspaper, they can't waive it. And actually, posting something like this gets this much more for that absent spouse as does putting it in the Daily Journal of Congress.
Well, and when you have to go out of state, then sometimes that costs money.
Thing that would concern me.
Yes, Seattle Journal of Commerce.
The thing that would concern me is that with all the deficiencies of publication, at least there is a clearly, demonstrably, provably public notice of publication. Whereas if it's a simple posting or a plain mailing, always a question whether or not the letter. It could always be raised whether the letter was really mailed, whether it was mailed to the last address, whether it was in fact posted. And all you have is somebody's affidavit who, let's assume everybody's honest, may just be mistaken, but it didn't get done. Even though I recognize what you say, the publication has this advantage. It is public. No way of cheating on it. And no way of incompetence taking over, and
I simply was going to respond that ordinarily these are published in the Daily Journal of Commerce, and the type of people who need to have notice don't read that particular paper. And as far as I'm concerned, publication in that manner is as ineffective as the kind that you're describing.
Madam Chairman. Also, already in our statutes, we provide for this type of notice. You said pleading to certify that you mailed it and everything. It's a matter of proof.
How about in any other kind of a suit? Let's say if it involves land. Do we have any instances where this kind of service would be sufficient? Proposed service?
You could. You can certainly do it by publication in the newspaper.
What I'm saying is there any other, let's say if we were talking about the title to a piece of land, could we get jurisdiction, or do we have any statutes? I'm questioning, I'm not rhetorically arguing. Are there any other instances involving important rights of people where we have said in this state that this kind of service is sufficient to affect other substantial rights of people? I don't think you can do that on foreclosure.
You can do it on a, after the sheriff is executed, for instance, and then he has the property, the sale of that property. They're supposed to notice the courthouse.
That's on the sale after the.
After the execution.
But to get initial jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's different.
Any other questions of Senator Roberts? Did you have something you wanted to point out?
No, that's from the next bill.
Okay, Senator Gold, Mr. DeWinter, would you look up and see if you can find out what that United States Supreme Court case is that parallel to this bill?
Yes.
Senator Bill 29.
29?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Senate Bill 29 provides for the registration of a foreign domestic relations decree, and I think that you on the committee will want to do a little bit of your own research on this, particularly those of you who are lawyers, and probably have your assistant do some research on it. I might say, by the way, Senator Ivers, Representative Peck voted against the last bill that we were just discussing. I'm trying to keep you informed on this as we go along here. On Senate Bill 29, there is a problem in Chapter 24, which recognizes the enforcement of foreign judgment decrees, but it seems to direct itself only to money judgments and not to judgments dealing with equity cases, and particularly not with domestic relations. Consequently, domestic relations judges, when they have to take jurisdiction over a case, and ordinarily this occurs in a child custody proceeding where the divorce has been taken in another state, and then the party who has custody comes into Oregon, and then the child is in Oregon, what is the procedure by which the party out of custody can bring a matter before the court dealing with that child, or sometimes dealing with child support, or dealing with alimony? And in the cases of child custody, it's possible to bring a writ of habeas corpus, but in matters of child support and alimony, there is some question as to whether or not the foreign decree can actually be registered in Oregon so that the court can have jurisdiction. My experience has been in these cases to use the foreign judgment chapter and simply file a petition for the registration of the foreign decree and then go ahead and proceed on the case after the court then has accepted jurisdiction by the registration of the foreign decree. But I'm informed by the domestic relations judges that one of these days that can be challenged in the Supreme Court because they don't believe that they have complete jurisdiction under that, or for that matter, any jurisdiction, to register a foreign domestic relations decree. And so this is simply an attempt to try to provide a procedure whereby the foreign decree can be registered here as any other decree can be registered, so that the court then has jurisdiction, there'd be no question of this state having jurisdiction.
Well, that sounds like a can of worms to me.
Well, it's a can of worms if you don't do something about it, Vern. It can be a can of worms for the parties involved in it, because how does the court, let me give you an example of a case in which the divorce was taken in California. The children were awarded custody to the father, but he was a Marine. And the provisions of the decree was that the grandmother, who resided in Marion County, would have the physical custody of the children, although the father, who was the Marine and was sent to North Carolina, the legal custody was with the father. The mother, upon promises of by the father that she would have complete visitation and so on if she would allow this to take place, and she did not fight it in California, came to Oregon, which was her residence and which was the husband's residence when he was not in the Marines. And then the grandmother refused to allow the natural mother to have any visitation privileges. The question was, how does she get legal action to allow visitation privileges with her children? Does she have to go back to California? The children were in Oregon.
And the grandmother was in Oregon?
The grandmother was in Oregon. The father was in California. The mother came here, but the decree was taken in California.
You know, this raises another question, and maybe we could have our legal counsel think about it related, but not in this bill. The law used to be, and it's really ridiculous, in this state, the only court having jurisdiction to adjust a decree is the court where the decree was entered. Mm-hmm. And that ought to be changed.
Senator Cook, I asked the interim committee to put it in as an interim committee bill, but it was right at the end of our committee work. We didn't have time to discuss it. I would very much like to join with you in doing that.
Have a bill
or have the committee do it, just so it gets in.
What it would do is so that where if you have the child and or what is it, what you
well, wasn't there referring to Mr. the winner as if there's the circuit court of one county has jurisdiction and the court in another county can't modify the decree.
I'll give you a specific example of that. A decree was taken in Medford and the child was awarded to the mother, who then took the child to Montana, but she came back to Oregon just temporarily, and the father wanted to, because he was very much concerned about what was happening to this little girl, wanted to bring it before the court for consideration by the court to transfer custody while they were, in fact, in Oregon. I went to Judge Lewis and asked her to register the decree, and she says, Betty, I'm going to do it because of the urgency of this, based upon the affidavit that the father had given. And she says, I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to issue a bench warrant to take the child into protective custody. And we'll have a hearing on it. But she says, if somebody challenges this, you're dead. But she said, I'll sign it so that we can get to the child. And so then, so obviously, you know, there's nobody left down in Medford. Why should they go back to Medford to determine the fate of this little child?
I'm sure. Well, if you're registered for a decree, it matters you can't modify it.
You're talking about Senate Bill 26.
We're talking about 20,
you
don't discuss 29.
Yeah.
You can register the decree. It's just a matter you can't modify it.
Well, there is doubt, Senator Burns, under the registration of whether or not this actually applies to domestic relations cases, because if you'll continue reading, it talks about the debtor and so on.
It says any judgment, decree, or order of a court of the United States or any state or territory that was decided by the president of the state. I never realized there's never been any hesitancy in proceeding on them and even enforcing them, but it's always been a modification. That's the real problem. I don't think that.
You have 43-180 there? Are you looking at that?
No, I've got
24-01. Well, 43-01 says you can only enforce it by a suit, which there is either says that you can only enforce a foreign decree by a suit, even not even modifying it.
If you continue reading that language, Senator Burns, you'll see that it is really referring to registering the decree so that you can enforce the judgment. And the judgment and the language then discusses the collection of the money damages.
So if you read the whole chapter,
it just seems as though it has nothing to do with equity cases or particularly domestic.
You can certainly collect any child support that was due, alimony, attorney's fees, or anything awarded, but you couldn't do anything about it enforcing with respect to custody of the child.
Well, There's still, there's some doubts whether or not the judges feel that you could even register and act on them.
Maybe, could we have council maybe look into this a little more and see what the conflict is between the two sections and get down to it?
Other questions or something?
Could we ask our council to draft a bill covering this other matter internally within the state?
Thank you, Senator.
I might say, Mr. DeWitter, that when you do have it in another county, there's some way of transferring the case. I guess only the little part of the sentence can be done.
I don't think it can be done yet. Not really.
Maybe there is a provision to do it, but I'm not sure both judges are agreeable and both parties are agreeable to have done it. That's not legal.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Harrington is here, and so and he has some proposals on this area, so after Representative Peck has testified, I'm sure he will be able to clear the air a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Peck?
Madam Chairman, I didn't know that I was going to be called upon to do any explaining about these bills, just to be here and to be sure that it was known that a couple of them weren't unanimous, and that's all I'm here for.
Fine. Would you like to make any specific indications? I think Senator Roberts pointed out
the one on the it has to do with common law marriages. I voted no on.
If you voted no on that, that's Senate Bill 21.
I realize that this doesn't just automatically legalize all common law marriages, but I questioned whether or not a person had been previously married and had children from that marriage and had set up trusts for them and made out his will and all taking these care of these children, what would happen if a common law marriage, maybe a couple of them, were recognized later, and how would these children from the original marriage be protected? Could these children from these other alliances, or whatever you want to call them, step in and upset all of the, would they have the right to upset all the plans that were made originally by the original spouses for the protection of the children if anything happened? This was one of the questions I had, and of course I don't want to do anything to encourage common law marriages, and I regret very much that we're giving welfare to a lot of them and all. I just don't believe in them, but the main question I had in this particular legislation, notwithstanding Mr. Harrington spoke in favor of it, is that I just wondered how this would jeopardize the interest of the original children of this marriage. Trusts that might have been set up for them and wills that had been made and all. What rights these kids would have to come in and upset that original setup just bothered me.
Well, I think one problem, if you look at Senate Bill 21 on line 15, I don't think there are going to be a couple of these marriages being assured because they have to have the immediately preceding the date of death. But that doesn't answer all of the problems.
Well, I just know that we have in one case, one man did have an ADC, one man with three spouses of one man were on ADC, legal spouses were on ADC. So I was just afraid this could happen in the field of common law marriages too,
well,
you know.
There's no freedom in that.
And but then there are people like that, I guess, in this world. But I was thinking of these original children how anyone could step in and upset the plans that their father or mother had made for them at the time that they were married. And
Senator, it seems to me, first of all, except as it relates to minor children who are living at the time of the decedent's death, I think that a parent can disown everybody in the world as long as he takes the proper steps and names them in the will. Children can be disinherited, unlike spouses, with no problem, except that if they are minor children, who are dependent upon that child. I believe there's a provision where you can go against the will under the support provisions. Isn't there a provision for so much can be ordered to support these children of the marriage during some period of time? I don't know how long it is. Not an awful long time. It's a year or two.
Yeah, but they can. They can't escape their responsibility to support the child simply by making a will.
That's the point. They're, except for in cases where there are minor children who are dependent upon that parent, that person for the support, I don't think that they could upset any plans laid by the parent. Follow me?
No, I don't, sir.
What
because it would
say?
Seem to me people move fast, you know, and there could be children from the first marriage who were not grown up. They're still minors, and they could be in college or some special school or receiving some special training because of something their parents, when they were together, set up for them. And here, all of a sudden, they're faced with the fact that their daddy's been shacking up with somebody else, and so he comes, and these kids can step in and... You get out of college, there's, you know, they're going to upset this trust or whatever these arrangements made for these first children. To me, this could be pretty serious in many cases. Interrupt educations and training and all sorts of things besides of what it would mean to these children from the legal marriage that had came before. And I'm not an attorney, and I don't pretend to be one. I've worked with some pretty good attorneys, but to me, I am a child of divorce, and nothing like this came up in my life, and my father never looked around to marry or shack up with somebody else and bring me brothers and sisters. But anyway, I can see where it has happened. I've known other children divorced who have been faced with some pretty miserable things. And maybe it's funny, Senator Cook, but I don't feel that way. I feel it's pretty darn serious for these kids. And and this is one of the reasons that I voted against it and wanted it known that I voted against it. There were other things, but I won't bother you with them. But this is one of my real concerns.
Madam Chairman, I think that Representative Peck should be advised that there was a suggested amendment to this. If there is a will or anything like that, a contract. That would indicate providing for the people who are living together to not intend for the other to inherit from their estate. And this way of overcoming this, I think, meeting the problems you're talking about, where they set up a trust or something for a child.
And that trust would be sacred to the child of the first marriage,
yeah,
or the marriage.
Yeah, we have an amendment to this to accomplish that.
I haven't
maybe
seen the amendment.
We just discussed it before you came in.
Any other questions?
Not on this bill.
Well, let's just go through them, Grace. Did you want to make any comment on 22? I think you voted in favor of that.
Mm-hmm.
And 23 is the one that prevents an action by a foster parent against the child except for the gross negligence. I don't remember how you
I voted okay on that one, I'm sure.
23, 26.
I had some reservations. I don't know how I found it. I can't remember for sure if I voted no on that, but I had some reservations because I was much opposed to this idea of foreclosing by mail, registered mail, you know, and I fought that when we got out, when we changed that law, and I can remember when the notices, besides advertising, the notices used to be in the middle of the bridges and in the courthouse and those sort of things, these notices that are concerned in this 26, so that people did get a chance to see them or look for them in places other than through by a publication in the Daily Journal of Commerce or something. I was a little afraid here of... people, you know, finding themselves divorced and children taken away from them or something when they didn't really know about it, and had they been sure, they could have, you know, their lives of the kids might have been a little bit different. And so I didn't make a real issue of that one, but this number 27 and the age.
No, we're not on that today, Representative. 29.
Which one is that?
That's the registration of foreign decrees relating to custody and support.
Well, I didn't vote no, I'm sure on that.
I don't think you did.
No, but I did vote no on 27.
Right, well, you'll get notice on 27 when we have hearing.
I don't know, I have to double check. I've been so busy with some other problems in the house side.
Madam Chairman?
Senator.
I was wondering, Representative Peck, what would you think on 26? Thought just occurred to me. Maybe some of the problem that I would have on this might be solved by having a central filing place, like the county clerk, mm-hmm. where you would file the notice at the time that it was allegedly given. In other words, instead of publishing it, you'd have some sort of a procedure where you make a filing of the notice ahead of time. Does that work or not?
Well, I just have in mind having protection for the children, really, because sometimes they wouldn't even know anything like this is going on. The parents are separated, and maybe one's staying with Aunt Jenny and one's staying with Uncle Joe, or maybe they're with total strangers, or maybe they're in foster homes. And what happens to these parents now, and the divorces and all, is doggone important to that kid, because when they become a child of divorce, that opens a box to lots of troubles in their future life. Fortunately, mine has been pretty good, but there have been some bad things in my life as being a child of divorce, and my brother's too. And I'm thinking of these kids, and I don't want to have something that's just going to permit one parent to just step in and take over and not let someone, maybe the mother's away or the father's away for very good reasons. And maybe work, the father's working, maybe his work takes him from place to place, maybe the mother too. Maybe she's seeking some comfort or something somewhere else. Or maybe she's just living a bad life somewhere else. But even then, she's their mother and has a chance. And I just want to be sure that both of these people will know and can show their proper interest in these kids, and the judge who hears the case can determine which is the best thing for them. So I just wasn't sure that this was good enough.
Further questions, Representative Peck? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for the courtesy.
Doing the live stream.
Nice to see you again, Grace.
Nice to see you too, Mr. Speaker.
To the proponents of the bill, Mr. Harrington, would you like to speak to the witness chair? Could you state your name, Mr. Harrington?
Francis E. Harrington, attorney, 1737 Northeast Broadway in Portland.
I don't remember which of these bills you had a particular interest in. I think you did have in 21, did you not?
No.
That's the common law.
I had no particular interest in it. I was asked to testify concerning it, and I expressed my views because I have a deep interest in this area of legislation. I have one suggestion for the committee on it, and that is that I believe the bill should be amended to provide that a part of the period of residence with the spouse should be in the state of Oregon. Now, what you're doing in this bill is eliminating the need for proof of marriage where none exists. And I would suggest language such as this. Provided to be inserted on line 9 after surviving spouse, provided that in either of such situations the party shall have been residents of this state for not less than 1 year prior to the death of the party. You see, what you might well have are people who have lived in other states for these periods of time, and they would come to Oregon and one die, and Oregon would be declaring them to have contracted a common law marriage, not by virtue of any residence in Oregon, but by virtue of residence elsewhere. And I believe that the since the purpose of the bill is to establish this presumption for Oregon residents, that a minimum of 1 year's residence should be required in the bill.
Yes. Isn't that a little bit illogical? Aren't we really concerned with providing equal treatment to those children who, for one reason or another, were the product without the benefit of matrimony? When we're talking about distributing money, if it's in a state, obviously, that's administered in this state, it's not going to have any effect on an estate administered in another state. Really, how is that? I don't see how that can be logical that we should say that we're concerned if this residence has been in Oregon, and therefore we're going to say that this child is going to share in an Oregon estate. But if they happen to have had this identical residence in California, then we're not going to allow this share in that estate.
Well, if you follow this further, we would declare them to be husband and wife under your theory if they lived in another state and owned property in Oregon. Then we would say that if they owned property in Oregon, but the death occurred in another state, and the property was owned as tenants by the entirety in Oregon, then we would follow the survivorship theory as to that property. Rather than theory that the property would be owned as tenants in common if the parties were not married and had not provided for survivorship under the provisions of that case whose name I've forgotten, but which carried out the joint tenancy theory, where you have to declare the consequences of joint tenancy if you wish to have it.
Erickson, that's one of the few.
It's the Erickson case, then. But we'd have the application of that case to parties who live outside of Oregon, and we would be declaring the existence of a common law marriage, in effect, between persons who are residents of another state.
Let's put it positively. How do you justify it for Oregon residents, but don't justify it for non-Oregon residents? Bearing in mind, we're talking about property distribution here. We're not talking about child custody or any of these things.
Because Oregon, as a sovereign state, legislates with respect to its citizens.
Oh, yeah, but I mean morally, in principle. Let's have some principle.
Well, all right. I don't think that the state of Oregon ought to impose its philosophy upon the residents of other states who may not choose, who by non-residents here haven't chosen to subject themselves to the jurisdiction. Here are people who live in a community property state. They live in California or Washington. And yet we can declare that they have a common law marriage, if the marriage if they're recognized as having a common law marriage in Oregon, then would not the determination of the Oregon court be binding in the other jurisdiction with respect to the property?
Carry that one step further, France, could be where they actually were citizens, residents, the law could be specifically contrary to this, where common law marriages were not recognized, and the children, they could be property in both states, which you'd really get then into a...
Well, of course, common law marriage is not recognized in Washington or California.
Idaho.
I think it, I think there are limitations on its recognition in Idaho. There are only about 7 states now where common law marriage is recognized.
Why did you pick a the period of time of 1 year, Frank?
I don't think this is Mr. Harrington's bill.
This isn't my bill.
Oh, I see.
What?
It was just suggested amendment that it would be 1 year.
Oh,
I'm
yes.
I'm curious to know why you picked the period of time of 1 year.
I have no feeling on it. I would, because of the attitude of the Supreme Court, I'd have no thought about reducing it to 6 months.
Well, my thought was that if people really came here with the intention of establishing their domicile, their residence here, and spending the rest of their lives, what difference does it make whether it's 1 year or 1 week?
It really doesn't, so far as I'm concerned. But the reason for my suggestion of the 1 year period is I want to make it clear to the rest of the country that Oregon is not attempting to impose its views on common law marriage upon the people throughout the rest of the country. And if you don't have some time limitation, you very often have the case of people who come from other jurisdictions to live here and yet will not have terminated their property relationships in the other state.
Another question, Chairman. I realize this is not your bill, but I know you have great expertise in this field, and I'd like to capitalize upon it if I could. The purpose of the bill is to certain benefits from this marriage exist after the person they live with dies. It seems to me, if that's the purpose of it, that perhaps we ought to take into consideration the workman's compensation benefits. Perhaps we ought to look at the Social Security laws to see if we should have special language here to qualify there under the Bureau of Economic Compensation, DEC cases, the Federal Act. There they do recognize common law marriage. I mean,
yes, common law marriage is recognized under the Social Security Act.
But it would seem as if we should check those statutes. Perhaps this should be a job for legislative council to make sure that we're using language that's compatible with that. And I think we ought to consider workers' compensation benefits.
Well, these would be provided because if the decision is that the parties are married, then there is automatic entitlement. State Industrial Accident Commission would recognize the... No problem.
The bill you were particularly interested in is Central 22, is it not, Mr.
I did not get a copy of this bill printed.
Is there one on the table?
There is one on the table.
This is an incorporation of the criteria for awarding custody suggested by Judge Lewis.
It's the addition of Section 2, and I would approve it completely. I have no suggestions relating to it. I recognize now I have seen it.
Senate Bill 23 is a short one. I realize you didn't come here for that, but you might, as an expert, give us your reaction.
Yes. So far as 23 is concerned, I looked at um, the statute. And what bothers me about it is the fact that it apparently, so far as I can determine, covers about 2% of the children whom it is intended to cover. Now, I would refer you to 418.625, which 418.625, which defines, which has the a definition of foster homes not supervised by child caring agencies. Now, the foster home is defined in 418.625 as a home maintained by a person who has under his care in such home any child under the age of 18 years not related to him by blood or marriage and unattended by its parent or guardian for the purpose of providing such child with care, food, and lodging, semicolon, but does not include any boarding school which is essentially and primarily engaged in educational work. Yeah. Overly concerned with that. Any home in which a child is provided board and room by a school board, or that. Any foster home under the direct supervision of a private child caring agency or institution certified by the division. Now, the definition of foster parent, as it appears in this bill, limits the children with respect to whom this bill is drawn to those who are in homes other than those under the direct supervision of a private child caring agency or institution. And it's my understanding that about 98% of the children who are in foster homes are under such supervision. And therefore, you've excluded everybody. What you want to do is protect the foster parent against this claim for ordinary negligence and so on. Now, by your definition, you've excluded most of the children in foster homes because most of them are in the child are in this child caring agency home.
Mr. DeWitter, would you check that point with Children's Services?
Well,
Why do you want to protect them in the first place? Why shouldn't a foster parent be responsible for their negligence?
For ordinary negligence, because the parent isn't.
Well, that's no answer. Why shouldn't the parent be responsible for ordinary negligence? In this day of women's and men's liberation, children's rights?
Because if we give the child an action against the parent for ordinary negligence, then we're opening the door to a complete breakdown of all family relationship. If I do work around my home, should I ask one of my children to assist me in doing it? And I might be negligent in the work I'm doing and cause injury to my child. My child then has a right of action against me so that all of my family assets may be taken by that one child away from everyone else in the family. If you give right of action within the family for ordinary negligence, we don't have it in the automobile case. We'd have to change our automobile laws completely. I take my children out for a ride. I miss the red light. Just one of those things and my children are hurt. Are you going to give them a cause of action against me for ordinary negligence?
Well, why not? After all, if we're concerned with the dignity of people, why should a child who is injured not be permitted to be compensated for the injury to his body, for example, just because by chance it's his father who goes through the red light rather than the man next door?
Because this would be totally destructive of the family relationship, and I would leave it at that. Anytime the child has the right of action against the parent or the foster parent for a matter of ordinary negligence, this is unintentional, this is not willful, this is carelessness that results in injury, then you're going to destroy all family integrity.
Well,
Now, but this is an attack, I regard it upon, as an attack upon the integrity of the family, and I think it would cause tremendous damage.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Mr. Hagner, did I understand you to say that you felt that most of the children, most of the protection attempted by this bill was eliminated by the citing of the statute?
By the definition, yes.
Yeah, well, and because most of those children are actually in foster homes.
They are in foster homes, but they're under the supervision of the child caring agency.
And are under the supervision of the child caring agency. All right. My question then is, as this bill was explained, I thought it was an attempt to ease the penalty for a foster parent to adopt children, and therefore expand the foster parent program rather than the foster child caring agency.
Well, the supervision of the foster home programs is primarily in the hands of the child caring agencies. They
right.
do most of the placement. Now, you've eliminated the coverage. You have the two children, one placed by in private contract or agreement in a foster home or by other than a child private child caring agency or institution certified by the division, and you've eliminated most of them.
Well, what you're saying then is you want the elimination of this kind of conduct extended to child caring agency as well as foster parents.
Yes, and to.
Well, you see, that goes beyond what I thought the bill was intended to do.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
I think Bob, you're misconstruing it. It's not the protection that's going to go to the child caring agencies mostly, but to the children that they place in private homes. It's for the protection of the foster parents, but who are placed by the agency or under their supervision. But it's still the protection is going to go to, and it would do exactly what you want to do, is to make the adoptions perhaps a little easier, or the, at least placement.
Oh, I see.
In my experience, I have had a number of foster parents, people who were willing to be foster parents, but who were afraid to accept the responsibility, because as to the child placed with them, they are subject to litigation arising out of ordinary negligence because they do not have the parental relationship to the child, whereas the child who of the natural child of the parents the parents are protected from claims of negligence from their own children. Now, this
I understand and agree.
And this is it. It's a matter of philosophy as to whether you want to give our children the right to collect from their parents for ordinary negligence.
Other questions, Mr. Harrington? Yes,
it seems to me that this bill came out of after we had the all-day meeting, if you'll remember, with the foster parents group.
Yes.
And they cited some cases that seemed to warrant this sort of protection. And it would seem to me that if someone should testify from their group, or we should have the testimony that was given the committee from their group to clearly understand the intent
yes,
of it.
Yes, we'll check the minutes of that committee and see that those people have a chance to be heard here. Senate Bill 26, did you have any comment on that?
Yes. Before coming here, I talked with Judge Lewis, and I understand that she has no objection to this bill, and she told me she intended to telephone to you. I disagree 100% with Judge Lewis.
I think I agree with you on one bill.
I feel that this bill is seriously defective. First, to my mind, it violates due process. what you would be concerned with here is the recognition of an Oregon decree based upon a type of service of summons and petition, which, to my knowledge, has never been tried in any other jurisdiction. Now, in the usual I understand the background of this case, which is that the legal aid attorneys asked, are having difficulty in getting the money to publish a summons in desertion cases where the their client is without funds. And I could be corrected, but perhaps someone could remind me. I believe the cost of publication of summons now in a dissolution suit in the Daily Journal of Commerce is $43.
Yes,
now, at the present time, that is the cost of publication of being the cost of publication of summons. There is a desire to avoid incurring that expense, particularly with respect to welfare people. Legal Aid brought a suit against the domestic relations judges to have them issue an order requiring the county to pay the cost of publication, and the judges refused to make such an order. Now, this is the bill that provides only for posting. Now, specific objection. First, I know of no area of litigation in which a copy of the complaint or petition is required anywhere to be posted. And this calls not only for the usual thing is that a summons or other notice may be posted. Here, the petition itself is required to be posted, and I regard that as out of line. Secondly, I believe there is an unconstitutional delegation of authority here, or an inadequacy in the act, when the legislature gives to the court the obligation to determine the place of posting. Because in common practice, what happens is that the attorney prepares the order providing for the place of posting, and I don't want to be overly facetious, but I would not be surprised if some attorney might try to put in an order requiring that it be posted in the ladies' room of the at Lounsdale Park or some other such place, because all that's required is that it be posted in a public place in the county in which the suit is filed. I regard that delegation as grossly improper and feel that it's the obligation of the legislature to fix the place of posting and the circumstances of posting. Now, here, this bill would seem to provide for only a single posting of the summons and not for any duration. I took a look at the requirements for giving notice with respect to elections, and they are most confusing, so I turned to simpler ones. The posting of the notices required in the foreclosure of various liens under the lien law. And I find this language on an ordinary possessory lien. Post notice thereof in three public places in the county, one of which shall be at or near the front door of the county courthouse. A dry cleaner's lien. Post notice of sale of clothing in the office where the clothing was received. Carrier or warehouseman. Post notice in two public places, one at the door of the courthouse. An innkeeper's lien. Post notice in three public places. The veterinary hospital lien. Where the pet is not picked up. Post notice in three public places, one of which shall be at or near the front door of the courthouse for 10 days prior to the date of the sale. And on a stable keeper's lien for the keeping of a horse, 5 days' notice posted in 5 of the most public places in the city where the sale is to be had. Now, you're going to have one posting somewhere to be determined by the court in this. I think this is utterly ridiculous so far as the adequacy of notice is concerned. I would be deeply concerned that a sister state would deny that the type of notice given here is adequate, since it may deprive a person of very, very substantial property rights in the dissolution proceeding. Now, as far as the mailing is concerned, this is going to be totally ineffective, because in 99 out of 100 cases, I would think, the copy of the petition and summons mailed to the respondent at his last known address is also going to be sent to the present or an address controlled by the petitioner. The respondent having lived with the petitioner at that place before deserting. So I think that's inadequate. Now, for other minor corrections, section 2, line 21, suggest that on line 6, the words void, declare a marriage void, or the words void or be eliminated, for the reason that that's descriptive of a decree of annulment. Page 2, line 6. I suggest the elimination of the words void or, for the reason that such a declaration is one of annulment. Line 10, obsolete language, strike the words or judge thereof, the third, fourth, and fifth words, so that it will read simply the court or a district judge. In line 11, strike the third word also. In line 12, the obsolete language is repeated, or judge thereof. Strike those three words. I object to the posting of the and petition in line 17. Line 20 again contains the words, or judge thereof. Section 2, the first word, not where, but when. Page 3, line 1, next to the last word, there is no letter. Substitute envelope for letter. Line 4, strike and petition. Line 7, strike and petition. Line 27, substitute, strike judgment and substitute decree. Line 27, strike action and substitute suit.
I had a perfect solution to get a proper notice, Madam Chair, which we would have some control over, because it would be a public media that was being put on public broadcasting and on TV.
Well,
Ivers and I already figured that out.
No. Local drive-in movie.
Senator Cook suggested a register of some sort at the courthouse. I do not feel this would be effective, because the suit is on file there anyway. I do feel it might be appropriate perhaps to provide that there might be consolidated publication in these cases, where a group of people, because the language of the summons and so on is the same, might have a single publication and the county, a county might contract, for instance, with the Daily Journal of Commerce for it, but this wouldn't solve the problem in other counties.
Chairman, another thing that might be done is we talk about checking the fact that it may have been last known address. And where we have substituted service on the director of the Department of Motor Vehicles, I think, for those in automobile cases where a person by driving in this state consents to be served that way can't be found. Before you can do that and do it by publication, the affidavit you require to file is a very detailed and complicated thing. You remember the Carroll case where they didn't put in time what was specified when they made the search, and you have to make a very detailed affidavit. So it seems like something like that might be required before you can have this type of service. In other words, you somebody at this house or that was an address, you say when it was done, you found out it was over here and so forth. It seems like that might be required. But again, you're running into the expense, which is what started all this.
You know, you might solve it another way. And you might, and Francis brought this up, you might permit certain individuals or agencies to simplify this to publish one notice for any number of suits. For example, you could say there are public, please take notice that there has been a divorce suit, noted attempted service in the following cases. John Smith versus Mary Brown, case number so-and-so. In other words, you cut the publication cost down to about $2 or $3 per each.
That's their name, but I don't think they needed a divorce suit.
Well, the point is, we're really concerned about the legal aid. They know what their names are. It's going to be as much notice as if you have that same hocus pocus that's in every summons, you know. And just have a list of people published. 50 of them.
Yes, if the court please, I took the liberty of rewriting the legislation. If I may pass this out. I felt that the bill was somewhat confusing. There were extra copies.
I just basically told Senator Burns that he's the quickest way to get these notices out would be to let the talk show know them. And they'll announce that there'll be someone listening here and they'll know them for sure.
Now, your problem, speaking to Senate Bill 29, the problem is that there already are these statutes relating to registration of foreign decrees. And what is involved in the intent of this bill is to provide a means whereby the custody support and welfare of children may be provided for with respect to children resident in the state with respect to whom there is a decree in force in a foreign state. The bill redefines foreign decree. And we already have a definition in the statute of a foreign decree. In the registration section on registration of foreign decrees in section 24010, the first section 24010, foreign judgment means any judgment, decree, or order of a court of the United States or of any state or territory which is entitled to full faith and credit in this state. Now, it isn't general decrees with which you're concerned. You want to cure a particular problem. And it isn't a matter of doing anything with most judgments and decrees of foreign states. 99% of which relate to money judgments and the collection of money judgments, but rather to give to the circuit court the authority to modify a support, custody, or welfare provision for a child resident in the state, but where the decree had been made in the other state. So I suggest that your purpose would be accomplished by having a special statute relating to the particular type of decree which you want to bring within the control of the circuit court, and I would call it a child-related foreign decree. It provides for custody, support, and welfare of minor children living in the state, and which is entitled to full faith and credit. Now, I have conformed in this suggested, in the writing that I've done, I have examined the language of our statutes and have brought the language into conformity with our statutes. So I suggest you're talking about a child-related foreign decree. You have the registration and a decree so registered, I take this from your bill, same effect shall be enforced in the same manner as a decree of a circuit court providing for custody, support, and welfare. And this is the language of our domestic relations law. That is, custody, support, and welfare rather than all welfare. Then much of the bill duplicated the language in ORS 24030. So I simply came back to requiring that the decree conform, that the petition for registration conform to the requirements of 24030, and allege that the decree sought to be registered is the valid decree governing the custody, support, and welfare of the minor children. Now, what happens frequently, of course, as we know, is that the decree has been modified in the other jurisdiction, and there may be modifications that have been made there. 24030 takes care of it. A copy of the judgment to be registered, the date of its entry, and the record of any subsequent entries affecting it. So any changes or modifications in the original decree in the foreign state would have to be registered in Oregon when this decree is presented for registration. Then the petition is to allege that it's the valid decree governing the custody, support, and welfare. The petition is to allege facts establishing residency of minor children. Then I took the exact language of our domestic relations law allowing modification of the provisions of a decree relating to care, to custody, support, and welfare, and I use that language for my section 4. After the child-related foreign decree has been registered, it may be modified, altered, or set aside in the manner provided by ORS 10703135, which is that provision of our domestic relations law giving our circuit court judges the right to modify a decree entered in this state.
Madam Chairman, wouldn't it be, what would you think of the idea of providing a minimum residence in the state before this can be provided?
No, absolutely not.
Don't you think there's a danger that we'll have, I've had it in reverse, runaway parents, they leave Alabama with the kid and race out to Oregon, and then bring a copy of the Alabama decree and file it and establish jurisdiction in Oregon to handle the thing, and yet everybody's still back in Alabama, except the kid and the father or mother that run out to Oregon.
Well, of course, the facts establishing the residency of the minor children in the state is going to call to the attention of the court the duration of the residency and the circumstances under which the children were brought to this state. And the court is going to be apprised of all the details and information respecting it. I assume that's why the draftsman specifically required that the petition set forth the facts establishing the residency of the children in the state. And we certainly aren't going to go to the registration of these foreign orders, and then their immediate modification without a showing of good faith permanent residency here. I'd leave it to the judges.
Couldn't that be a great burden on the people where it took place in Alabama, and suddenly the father or mother of a child or the other one got on a plane and came out here and did this, that forced them to suddenly appear in Oregon to fight about whether or not that decree should be changed?
I would prefer to leave it to the discretion of the judges. These are emergency matters. You're now talking about the custody, support, and welfare of a child who resides in Oregon, and I feel that our circuit judges would require that at least some reasonable notice be given before making a change. And certainly it would be based upon evidence and hearing and so on. I do not see any difficulty with this. And we do have the case that there, and I have a number of cases in my practice where the support decree was made in another state, and we have difficulty in having it modified here.
Well, the question is, what if we had? Would it really be such a burden to say that this shall only apply where the child has been domiciled in this state for a period of, say, 1 year?
I think you can't do it this way
unless they've been here a year. And this isn't completely. This is not a substitute for what do they call those proceedings in juvenile court? If there's a real problem, you can almost always go into juvenile court.
You're arguing for residents.
Well, I think there's a difference here. There's a different principle involved. Here we're talking about, what I'm concerned about is the possible abuse by a fleeing parent, if they were aware of this law, coming from a distant point, attempting to suddenly, would have been here a week, let's say, or less than 2 weeks, trying to confer jurisdiction on the court in Oregon to change that decree. Just coming here for that purpose. I'm concerned that unless we have some minimal residency so that we eliminate that possibility, that they really, honest to goodness, want to come here and live.
This concerns me a little bit. Senator Cook is saying, let me preface what I really want to ask you another question. This will overcome the very expensive and very difficult and complicated proceeding where a parent comes here, then somebody else comes out and files a habeas corpus proceeding and so forth. And you've got the conflict of law and various other things to face. What Senator Cook raised doesn't bother me, and it seems as if with the language that you have here, you're tying the hands of the judge because you're saying that you shall proceed the same way you would on a decree entered by that judge. Really, you're saying that because with something we discussed before you came here, that you can't even shift these things around between counties. Well, not the judge, because it could be a judge in the same judicial district. It seems to me that perhaps language should be added to say, taking into consideration the length of time they've been in the state, and the reasons for coming here, or something like that, giving the judge a little bit of latitude to take care of the situation that Senator Cook has raised.
Well, it seems to me that where the petition is to allege the facts establishing the residency of the minor children in this state, that you're giving the judge full information with respect to the duration of the residency, and of course, there would be. First, you have the registration. Now, the next thing you have is the modification of the decree or judgment entered in the other state. Now, this modification is only going to be made upon due process and due notice to the other parent. And this is the same thing that we require in our present decrees. Let's take the case of the child who is resident here in the state, the divorce, dissolution here, and the father has moved to New York. Now we want to effect a change of custody or a change in visitation rights in custody. Or we want to provide money for a college education or for some other purpose or for medical expense or something. That parent in New York has to be notified of it and given an opportunity to appear, and due process must be followed. And there would be no modification or change or anything of that sort which would affect the right of the other parent without following due process and giving adequate notice of the modification, because it's required under our law, under 107.135.
It doesn't make any difference how much notice you give them, but they can't come.
Well, this
and,
is...
And you know these cases I talk about where they often is not there. They're usually coming home to mama, and they got somebody here to finance their case, and they've left the other spouse back there, and one of the reasons probably left is because he didn't have a job or something, and he couldn't get out of here if he wanted to, so you could notify him by personal service. It wouldn't do him any good. It just seems to me that I'm not sure correcting this, but it came to mind that I think we may be tying the hands of the judge a little bit too much, and he ought to be able to take into consideration the reason why the child's out there anyway. And after all, residency of the child, what we're talking about, not residency of the spouse. And the child's residency is established here. The minute he arrives here, the parent intends to stay. Isn't that true?
Well, the child would be a resident if he did, but the duration of the residence certainly would be a matter presented to the court in the petition for registration and thereafter. You see, you first have this petition for registration, and once the petition for registration has been allowed and the decree has been registered, then you have the proceedings for modification that are carried through on just as if this were an Oregon decree.
Well, I think Francis covered. I was going to say, would there be any value of in having a copy of the petition filed back where the original decree had been granted, which would put that jurisdiction on notice?
Well, it is put on notice. That's the provision.
If they are under the modification.
The clerk of the registering court shall notify the clerk of the court which rendered the original judgment that application for registration has been made, and shall request him to file this information with the judgment.
That's in the statute.
That's in ORS 24030, and it was in the original bill.
Other questions, Mr. Harrington? Thank you, Mr. Harrington. Were there other persons who wished to be heard on any one of these bills today? Did anyone wish to present any testimony on Senate Bill 21, 22, 23, 26, or 29? These bills will be heard again at another time, and I gather the committee would like to hear from Children's Services One other item of business, would the committee care to authorize me to enter bills at the request of this committee that come from the Oregon State Bar and from the Commissioners on Uniform State Law?
I so move. Excuse me, I'll second.
All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Move to adjourn.
So move. Thank you.